This is Whitley Strieber, and this is Dreamland. You've reached the edge of the world.
Welcome back to Whitley Strieber's Dreamland, that happy hunting ground that rests along the liminal corridor between humankind and the cosmos, wonder and the strange, aliens and that deepest part of every conscious being. I'm James Falk, host of Neon Galactic and monthly guest host of this vaunted program, your second choice for favored psychopomp, but someone who loves as much as you to engage with life's biggest questions. Don't forget to like this video, follow this podcast, and let us know your thoughts and theories in the comments. Answers will only come through joint inquiry and the communion of many minds mulling on the mysteries. Our guest today is an author, thinker, musician, and friend, someone who loves to dwell on the big questions around UFOs, non-human intelligence, consciousness, art, music, and humankind. His several volumes explore the transcendent spaces, seek out meaning where magic and creativity have twinned themselves into a dancing pair. They make you laugh with joy and insight at the absurdities of being alive and striving for truth in a world where certainty is almost certainly a mistake. This dude is genuine and wise beyond his beautiful words. Mescalito riding his white horse, for all we know, UFO Symphonic, and The Inner Space of Outer Space, among others, offer the reader an opportunity to engage both intellect and imagination, heart and mind, in a journey toward expanded awareness and profound engagement. So let's join him there, on that sojourn, and see where his white horse leads. Welcome, Mike.
James, what a wonderful interview, but introduction. But you always do that, so thank you. You're always so thoughtful. I couldn't have said it better myself. I wouldn't have said it that way. But I really appreciate that. Thank you so much.
Well, I appreciate that coming from you because you are quite the beautiful writer yourself. Your books are full of wonderful imagery and poetics and thought that is, I think, central to what we're all trying to figure out when we talk about these subjects and get caught up in the zeitgeist of the strange, which I am firmly entrenched in at this moment. First off, I want to kind of honor the fact that, we've talked several times before. I've read your books and I think they're fantastic. And then when I was thinking about a guest for this week's show, I was like, who could I talk to that, could have a general conversation? And I'm like, Mike's a great guy. Like, it would be a good conversation. So I reached out and you happened to be in my area, which for folks who don't know, I live in a very scarcely populated corner of Northern California in the Redwoods, Humboldt County, Eureka, California. And Mike was like half an hour away and he lives in New York City. That's like cosmic, man, right? Like, wouldn't you say?
That's incredible. And I just looked for giggles. I looked up, I knew what Eureka means because it's like when you discover something, but it means I have found it. Mm-hmm. So we kind of found each other.
We did. It was kind of a beautiful thing.
It's funny because I've mailed stuff to you. I've mailed, books to you before we met. And I said, yeah, I know James lives in Cal, but it's a big state. So, yeah. I didn't think of it. And then when you reached out, it's like, wait a second, I'm in Humboldt County. I'm like,
we were able to meet and have coffee, which is a rare treat for me. I mean,
me too. It's great to have these worldwide connections, mm-hmm. Talking to people in Scotland and in the Netherlands and all over this country. But I like the good old days when you could reach out and touch someone and, be there and physically meet. It was really great to meet you.
I love Zoom. I mean, I think it's enabled a lot of great conversations and, but there's nothing quite like being in the same place, enjoying a cup of coffee and just actually getting to see someone in the flesh. I think it's something we all have kind of neglected. Maybe we're getting back to, hopefully. But the reason why I wanted to talk to you, this is something that I've kind of covered on episodes of my show recently, and that's Neon Galactic for folks if you want to check it out. But it's about, I guess loosely you could call it inspiration. I've been doing some reading about the history of science, for example. Mm. And in particular, the relationship between Carl Jung and Wolfgang Pauli. Mm-hmm. And they wrote letters back and forth as they kind of wrestled with their respective fields, but then also they were kind of doing a joint inquiry to figure out how archetypes, were at work in the universe. And Wolfgang Pauli was convinced that Jung was onto something and had, began to believe that even certain numbers were archetypal forces and stuff. But in that book, they talk a lot about how scientists get their ideas. And there was a several descriptions of moments where there had been an epiphany by a particular scientist, and suddenly things that he had been working on were suddenly made clear. And it was described as almost a handing off of information. Like it wasn't necessarily, they thought through A, B, C, D, E, straight through to from one point to another and, fixed it in their minds themselves. It was like somehow there was something outside of themselves that was handing them this idea. And it reminded me of the sort of Greek idea of the daemon, and others have talked about it. Bernardo Castro recently wrote a book where he says that he believes he's been in contact with the daemon. And so that kind of, I think resonates with the idea of non-human intelligence and, a lot of what we've talked about on this show and other shows, and even Diana Pasulka's work. That is very similar to what artists often describe in terms of how they receive information. And you have written a lot about music. You're a music scholar, a musicologist, but you're also a brilliant writer. So I thought you would be a really good person to talk to about that idea of, inspiration and what you might think, is happening, with creativity and the human mind. So explain it to us, would you?
Yes, yeah. Well, I'll do my best. First of all, I do want to point out, so this when scientists make that discovery, they use the word eureka. So interesting that connection. I think that yes, I think there's what people call downloading. So there's this, and Diana Pasulka talks about it. Of course, you read about it everywhere. In some cases, and I think there's always a spectrum of how these things happen and how they happen to individual people. And there's never like one kind of answer. For me, what I would say is that I love that there's an expression in my ex-wife is Russian, and to be a writer, you have to have, in Russian, it translates as you have to have a good ass. And what that means is you have to sit down and do the work.
Yeah,
And
for sure.
writing is really, and I think any creative work, there's the sweat that we put into it, the sweat equity, and there's that getting the machinery ready. And then there's also, then there's that, and then there's the inspiration. And then there are people like, how do you say his name? Ramanujan, the Indian mathematician who
Yeah,
said,
who's someone I talked about
whispered.
recently. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like
The purple
whispered,
goddess.
right? Like now that isn't me. It doesn't quite happen like that. I don't just get someone whispering to me. I do on some level, but there's I'm meeting the deity halfway. So and what I mean to say is, so say say UFO symphonic, right? I'm making this connection between music and the phenomenon. So as you and I refer to the phenomenon, it's an all-inclusive term that means that can include the paranormal, can include UFO encounter experiences, could include Marian apparitions. It's a big umbrella that includes many things. It's the anomalous. Could include psychedelic states and experiences that you may have in those states. And what I in my process, because you said you wanted to talk about that, what I really, first of all, I love that I always tell people, and I think people sometimes misconstrue it. I say, I'm just a writer. And I'm not putting down anything. I'm just saying I'm like a guy at the I'm the guy in Hades that's just working with my hammer and just banging on metal trying to put it into shape. But when I get obsessed with a topic or interested in a topic, I kind of swim in it, I breathe in it, I dream about it, and I keep my dream journal near me. And there's it's a very kind of interactive two-way thing where I'm setting the stage, I'm thinking about it, and I'm inviting. So I'm inviting the deities in to kind of join me in this conversation. And it is a conversation. When I began, for instance, a UFO symphonic, I had to keep modifying what I was trying to say until I finally got to a place where I had a better understanding of what it is I was going after. So someone might say, you know, is that a scholarly approach? Well, I'm a creative. I'm a creative writer. I very much I try to bring scholarship into the work, but I don't have an agenda where I have this is my credo by which I live, and I'm going to live and die on this hill. You know, that's not how I operate. I'm exploring. My writing approach is very much exploratory. And so in for example, in UFO Symphonic, what it came clear to me is that first of all, I discovered something that I was going after music initially. So what is the connection between music and non-human intelligence, if you want to say, or the phenomenon? What I discovered, it's more than music, it's sound. So that was a discovery that was part of the process. So this would have to include sound baths. This would have to include, I did some gong yoga experiences. I went to a shamanic ceremony, which involved chanting and drumming. Of course, that's music too. But to anyone interested in spirituality, chanting, humming, prayer must be included in that world. What I also learned, and I kept my approach very open. So I said to my inquiry to folks was, can you tell me a story that relates music and or sound to something inexplicable? So wide open. And consequently, I got a plethora of stories, but not a lot of repeats. So I know you read the book. It's been a while ago. Frankly, I can't remember some of the things from it myself. After I write something, I can't always remember everything that I've written. You know, I'm often moving on to the next thing. But there were stories about there was one story about a good friend of mine, Frank, who had his partner who died young. She was a violinist. And an amazing violinist and fiddle player, really. She was kind of bluegrass, but could play really anything. And there was this story that he told me that our good friend Peter Rowan, whom you know, I wrote about in Mescalito Riding His White Horse, he met with Peter Rowan and he had this song he wanted to write with Peter Rowan. So they went to, there was a festival that they went to, they met at. The next day they get together for breakfast at Frank's house, and there's a box with Susan's flute that has not been touched because you know Frank's like honored you know his dear beloved's things and kind of kept them, but he hadn't opened it. He knew it didn't play. Peter took out as Frank is telling him the song, he's basically telling him the story of the song. And Peter is acting like he's not really paying attention, kind of, but he's toying with the flute. He asked Frank's permission. May I look at this? What is that? Wow. May I look at it? He puts it together. While Frank is telling Peter the story, Peter, who it looks like he's not paying attention, says, okay, here's the first verse. Right? He kind of gets he starts giving the verses to Frank. Then he plays the flute and he comes up with the melody. Now, Frank's just caught up in all of this, and actually he recorded it, Frank. And I listened to the recording. And they finish the song, and Frank has contributed the chorus to the song. He gave the theme to the song, but Peter wrote the lyrics and created the melody. And then afterwards, they kind of get through that. They put it down. They're talking again. Peter picks up the flute and it won't play. And that there's something now. Frank has a very special relationship to Susan. He loved her very much, and his grief is very palpable. But the power, the magic of, so did Susan just kind of, you know, emerge from here? You know, what happened here? How did this happen? And it was just a mystery. And, you know, that's one story. Is that a UFO story? It's not really, but it fits into the anomalous, the strange. Maybe someone can go and tell me the physics of that and the science of that and all of that. But it was very peculiar. And you probably know Michael Shermer.
Yeah.
He's the famous skeptic.
Yeah, he has famously, a story. He's now on the panel, the UFO panel at the White House.
Right.
He was named
right.
To a lot of people's chagrin. But yeah.
Right. He's the wrong kind of skeptic, you know, as we all, he's focused on proving things aren't just so.
Yeah.
Which I take the opposite approach as you and I do. And there are other scholars that do that are highly respected. So this is just a choice. Mm-hmm. But Michael Shermer has a story that he talks about when he got married. He has an inexplicable tale. And I have that as like the footnote to Frank's story. He says that it's, I'll briefly tell it, that
yeah,
he got married and he's in his house. It doesn't matter where, but they hear music coming from somewhere, he and his wife. And they finally find it's an old radio that is playing old music that, and I believe it was her uncle's, something like that. It was someone's radio and who had passed and who couldn't be there. But the music that was playing was from his era. And Michael, being the skeptic, you know, took the radio apart, dismantled every piece, tried to figure out what was going on. The thing only played one time. It only played, and he could not foot what happened.
Yeah.
So even a skeptic like him, he had to say, well, I just don't know.
Yeah, I remember that story. And as I remember, and I could have it wrong. So, but it had to do with, it was playing a love song, and her father couldn't be at their wedding,
right.
Her dad, because he had passed. And so the song played a love song that only played the one time, and then it quit working, like you said. And
Right.
so he was struck with the, not only the fact that it worked, but it was a synchronicity for it to play that night, which was, I think, their wedding night or the night before their wedding. She was really grieved that he couldn't be there. And then this radio starts playing sort of miraculously with this love song right prior. And he was shook by it. And for a little while, he was kind of like, maybe I need to rethink, because this is a weird circumstance. But then later he rationalized it away and decided that it was just a coincidence.
Right. And in the book that I had where it was mentioned, it was left unresolved. So it was just sort of, you know, mentioned and not really resolved, but it fit in with the story that I told. And the point I'm trying to make is the stories that I received were highly diverse. And it was an interesting journalistic experience. The people I talked to, I firmly believed what they were saying. This was what united most of these stories, was something around grief and trauma.
Yeah.
James Iandoli's story, I think I mentioned to you when we met in Humboldt, that he was driving and he saw a UFO as he was driving, and it sort of moved. But, you know, he's driving on a street and there are buildings and things that you can't just like drive through the building to follow it. And then it sort of became a plasmatic, like kind of sphere, and it morphed. And then it went away. He followed it for some bit. Then sometime later, he's in that general same area. He'd been working late nights, and his car crashed, and he fell asleep because he'd been working late. He'd been working too much. And he went into this, he had a near-death experience in that same spot. And in that experience, he heard, I'd heard him tell the story on a podcast, and then I said, "Hey, James, I'd like to talk to you about this and use that story for the book." And he had this. First of all, he had these beings tell him, assure him, even though he was in that state, he said he felt at peace, calm. And then he had this beautiful, like celestial symphonic music come out of the, it just began, it emerged. That kind of story happened a few times. That type of story where people heard something, some kind of incredible symphony they'd never heard before. But it wasn't every single time, for sure. And sometimes people have, there's no sound. It's just, it's almost, it's a silence. It's the Oz effect, kind of something is going on. It's this consuming silence that's maybe thick with a kind of sound, but it's not what we would think of as music.
We'll be back after this short break. UAPs, aliens, magic, breakthrough tech, psi phenomenon, esoterica, psychedelics, cryptids, time slips, poltergeists, and sundry. The days of dismissing these complicated human experiences as mere delusions, hoaxes, fantasies, and dreams needs to be over. Instead, we need to explore and understand these events for what they might be telling us about the nature of the universe and of ourselves. The ancients taught that we're each an energetic expression of the living cosmos, but we still don't know what that means. What is real? What is fantasy? How do each of our lives and experiences fit within the broader tapestry of being? Are we alone? Where does narrative fit? And what happens when we die? Join me on Neon Galactic, a podcast produced by yours truly, to push the boundaries of old paradigms in science, philosophy, ontology, anthropology, and more. This show is an experiment in radical hermeneutics, breaking down old walls to embrace the strange and existentially transformative, to get beyond old prejudices and realize at last that we are indeed more complicated and connected as a species than many of us ever dreamed. Find me on Patreon, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts to take a journey to unknown places on a quest to the limits of this reality and beyond. At such a fraught and dangerous moment in human history, the time has definitely come to reassess the wisdom of our ancestors and embrace the natural truths we've long rejected. Join our intrepid crew in throwing open the gates of perception to welcome wonder back into the workaday world.
You know, there's an incredible website in this world. You're listening to its podcast or watching it right now. It's unknowncountry.com. Founded by Anne Streber in 1998, it is a huge repository of information about the edge, practical, clear, carefully presented, not a bunch of nonsense, but the truth about the edge. The things that we really don't know, don't understand, and the right paths to go down to find the answers to those mysteries. UnknownCountry.com is absolutely unique in the world. And not only that, it's a load of fun to go on that website and just explore. So go to UnknownCountry.com, follow the news every day, because it is a great website and the news is hard-hitting and extraordinary. You're welcome, if you're a subscriber, to comment on any story, any podcast. You're welcome also to come to the Wednesday night chat room, which I usually attend myself. It's a wonderful place. So subscribe. Keep it going. $4.95 a month is not a lot of money these days. Should be more, frankly, but it's not. So do it today. Go to unknowncountry.com. Click on the subscribe tab. Help keep this marvelous, extraordinary project going. We need it more right now than ever before.
So that's interesting.
Yeah. I was lucky enough to have my own story included in there, thanks to
yes.
you. You had asked me for one, and it was interesting. It had to do with death and dying and trauma. Someone had been killed, and I figured out later the next day that right at the moment that person was killed, it seemed like, I mean, as near as I could reckon, my friend's guitar, who had a locking strap, you know, if you play guitar, you know that there are certain kinds of straps that are made to be super secure. And the reason why is because my friend was had type 1 diabetes, and so he was blind at that point, so he needed it to be really secure. We're in the middle of playing, and his guitar just, it seemed like, leaped off this strap and went smack on the ground, and this loud, like, really ugly sound occurred when all the strings were suddenly, like, violently, hit like that. And we were all kind of like overcome by this really, I don't know, ugly sensation, really ugly emotion, as a result of that. And the way that it lined up with the murder that happened a block or two away, stuck with us. And then later on, when I told them all that, they were like, "Oh my gosh!" Like, it does seem like it all kind of fits in a weird way, because it seemed like there was an energy that almost rifled through the room. As I mean, it was just really, really peculiar. So yeah, I mean, I think that all of that, I mean, somehow it's all connected. And it's interesting you were talking about the flute. My grandfather, who died 2 weeks after I was born, he was actually in the hospital with me when I was born. He was dying and I was being born, and he got to hold me. So that was like, a cool moment. But he was a musician, lifelong bluegrass player. So he had a banjo and he had a violin and a guitar. And my grandma always had them displayed. And so they were like holy relics. Like, there was something about instruments and those instruments in particular. But I find it's, about a lot of different instruments. And I don't know what causes this, but there seems to be an infusion in the material of it where, like, if you know the person who it came from and that story of all the different sounds that came out of it and the motion and work that a person put into it, there is really a sense of sacredness about it. And I wonder if that has to do with, like, that, the vibrations that go on a lot, around it are sort of vibrational reality. I mean, I don't know, but I've always felt that, and it's kind of a interesting thought.
Well, it's in the inner space of outer space, I talk about this notion of vibration. So, and by the way, just to mention that what was interesting about Pauli and Jung is they came, how they defined synchronicity. It wasn't that two things happened that, like these two things happened. It's that you manifested something. So there's the story of the scarab, the woman that he's talking with, and she's sort of obstinate and not willing to, she doesn't want to explore her irrational side. And she's talking about something about, she had a dream, right, about a scarab, an Egyptian scarab. And then they hear something in the window as he's sitting with her in his office. And this is in, where is he? It's in Switzerland, right?
Yeah,
And
Zurich, I think. Yeah.
which is a highlight, I mean, this is improbable. And the scarab is knocking on the window. And he produces, and she has this kind of like revelation. I think we can trust Jung that he's telling us a true story,
Oh,
but
yeah.
that she manifested it. But the notion of vibration, of sound, you talked about it, there is no doubt that when you're playing an instrument, I have a Martin guitar, and I've had it for, maybe 20 years now. I don't remember. When I first got it, it was stiff. I knew it was my guitar. I could tell it fit it because I'd gone through a bunch of them. When you're playing live, as you know, you don't want to wrestle with your instrument. You want your instrument to be, your friend. You don't want to struggle with the action's too high, the strings are just not right, your doesn't sit well in your body, it doesn't do the projection you want, it doesn't fit the style you're playing, etc. And this is not, this is, violinists and accomplished musicians go through this, and I'm not putting myself in that category. But when you play the instrument, you change the, through vibrations, through playing it, you change the physics of the instrument. It sounds different. It begins to, you're changing the molecular structure of it, of the wood, through the music you're playing, through all of that. Interestingly enough, I was at, I don't know if I told you this, but I was at Peter Rowan's house, and I went to visit him, and I brought my own little Taylor guitar, which is a travel guitar you can put in a the overhead bin, because when we see each other, the guitars come out and do a little song.
Can you do give us a nut graph on who Peter Rowan is for people who
Oh
might
yeah.
not
Oh,
know?
I'm sorry. So
It's okay.
Peter Rowan is he played with Bill Monroe. Bill Monroe is called the father of bluegrass, and I think it's fair to say that Bill Monroe codified. I mean, bluegrass. There was ragtime. There was old time. There was blues. There was country, but Bill Monroe crafted something that he felt it brought back the memories of his childhood with his uncle Penn and his mother singing. And he kind of brought together this style. It was intentionally fast. It was dance music. It also used high falsetto harmonies, gospel harmonies. So you have this, it sounded antique. He wanted it to sound antique. So he's playing this, yeah, high
Lonesome.
lonesome. Now, of course, that existed, that the high lonesome sound existed. And of course, gospel harmonies existed, but the way he put it, brought it together was unique. A young Peter Rowan, who was from Weymouth, Massachusetts, got very interested in bluegrass through a long story I won't tell. It's in the book Mescalito Riding His White Horse. But he played with Bill Monroe. So he was in his 20s, young guy playing with Bill Monroe. I mean, if you can imagine someone of that power. And Peter said that Bill had a there was a spiritual element when you're dealing with someone like that, someone who's a pillar of a form of music or an art. There's something. There's a They are a beacon of something. They're
Yeah, we talked
channeling
about
something.
that. Yeah, when we met, I want to get into that too. So, but go ahead, please.
And just to say, Peter played with him, and they wrote a song called Walls of Time together, which actually Peter's coming up with a memoir called Walls of Time, and it's an interesting concept. The song Walls of Time, it's about a lover, his lover woman dies, and he hears her through the wind, and he hears her through kind of the physicality of, but on the other side. Interesting concept Peter came up with. He hears her through the walls of time, whispering through the earthly elements, and
Very much
asks the
phenomenon, sort of, like
very
around
much,
the, yeah,
yeah,
totally.
very much, very much. I mean, Peter's, gets songs from deities, and he's someone who is very tapped into all of this 100%. But what was I getting to? I don't remember what I was talking about. Why did I bring up Peter?
I forget, in terms of the particular point, we were talking about how instruments age and they get
Oh
You
yes.
change their
Sorry.
molecular. Yeah, no,
Yes. I
it's
love
great.
when I lose when I where I'm going the thread, because that means I'm into in the moment. I think that's a great
Exactly.
thing. So I went to see Peter in California, where he's from. I was not where he's from, where he lives. And I had my Taylor guitar, which is, a little thing. It's actually well made. But I bring it to his house, we get together, and because I don't want to presume to play his instruments, they're his instruments. And he says, he's playing this beautiful tobacco colored Martin guitar from 1937. And he says, "Would you like to play this guitar?" And I was like, spit all over myself, and I picked it up. It was so light. It was like a feather. My Martin guitar, so mine is a 00028. This is a 37. It's a parlor guitar, but it was so light. Now, why is it light? I guess the wood that it's that was used, I mean, it's trees that you probably can't get anymore. And I started to play it, and it just sung beautifully. It just like was the wind blowing through it. And he said, he said, you're holding a bit of a you're holding a bit of history there. And he wrote Panama Red on it. He wrote a few songs on that. And he said, Bob Dylan, at the New York folk the Newport Folk Festival, asked if he could play the guitar and wanted to buy it from me. So I was playing the guitar that Bob Dylan, played, and of course Peter Rowan. But you really felt the power of that. Is that the the coming together of imagination and the thing itself. Yes, of course it is. You know, we, it's always participatory. It's always co-created. It's always joint, in my opinion.
Yeah.
But a long rambling way of saying, even scientists now, you know, the deeper we go into the atom, the deeper we go, we realize it's not yet smaller particles, it's vibrations. Or as the Beach Boys in the song, it's good vibrations, excitations. And that's what the physicists call it too. Excitations.
Let's take another break here and reconvene after with author and musician Mike Fiorito.
The president has directed the Defense Department to release all of its documents involving UFOs and aliens. There are rumors that this might actually happen, and even that they might tell the truth. If you read the Whitley Strieber Substack or my most recent blog on unknowncountry.com, I explain exactly why. But if it does happen, does it also mean direct contact with aliens from more people? What happens if they come into your life, your children's lives? It's not going to be abductions like it was in the past. It's going to be a very different experience, something much more like what happened to my family after the communion experience. I wrote two books about it, Transformation and Breakthrough. They were beaten to death by the media and not much read, but they remain the only chronicle of such an experience that has ever been put into print. They're a blueprint for how to make contact work, and it can work, and that is certainly very important. Governments come and governments go, but the visitors are going to be in our lives from now on, forever. So how do we handle this? Is it good? Bad? Are we in danger? Or at the start of something wonderful? Find out how one family made contact work in Transformation 2026, the massive update to the original book, available now on Amazon.com.
That whole thing, you know, I mean, like, it's one of those points that resonates with what the early wisdom traditions were teaching. I mean, like, even like the Kybalion talks about like the seven rules of the universe or whatever. And one of them is that all things are vibration. And this is something that, you know, the yogis back in the day understood. There's a fundamental truth that they were able to tap into through their consciousness, not through, you know, math and all of that. Although there was some, you know, sacred math going on in various traditions. But I think that somehow the nature of music reminds us of that. And as we were discussing at the coffee shop, like, it's a weird thing to me that there is an innate quality in music. And I don't think it's cultural, because I think it's something that even young children can understand. But the way that the ratios of harmonies, translate directly into emotional experiences for human beings. The classic idea is the dominant fifth resolves into the one. Like, you have, there is this question that's raised by a 5-7 chord, and it's resolved and back in the tonic.
Right.
Without that, you don't, I mean, you're left in suspension, and it creates this like tension. And all of the chords around the mode, you know, all have different emotional shades. And people often talk about, like, you know, the sad minor chord or whatever. And it's just this weird way that we have figured out how to, what do you call it when you, someone hijacks unlock a plane, unlock, but it's like, we can, it's emotional, it takes people on an emotional ride, and it's almost a direct correlation when you're playing the music and what someone else is experiencing. So, how did we get there? How did we figure that out? I mean, what was the process? I think that, again, we get back into that notion. Is it something that comes from beyond us or the collective us? Or I don't know, but it's magical. Yeah. Absolutely, it is magical and anomalous how it all sort of came about, I think.
And, you know, you go back to, you know, it's to the Greeks and, you know, their notion of the power of music and actually all cultures. But there are things that kind of make sense, right? That So if I go from G to A minor to B minor to C, you have 100 songs that I could do. Here, there, and everywhere. Bob Dylan's "You Knew," what's his "You Used to Laugh About Everybody That Was Hanging Out." What's the title of that song?
Oh my gosh.
I can't think of it right now, but then
Yeah.
there's "Loving You" by Minnie Riperton.
Tangled Up in Blue, isn't that
Oh,
what it is?
it's not "Tangled Up in Blue." It'll come to me in a
Oh,
minute,
okay.
and but it doesn't matter. But the song "Loving You" is easy, 'cause that's backwards, going from D to B minor to A minor to G, but it just kind of works.
Yeah.
So my feeling is, we discovered those things. They're somehow, are they the ultimate and the only? No, but they do work.
Yeah.
Where in the West we focus on like layering and architecture and music, in the East, these are generalizations, there's
Yeah.
more of a focus on timbre,
Yeah.
on color. So the sitar and the drone of that, and also the voicings, the singing.
Yeah.
So it's you'll hear more color, and maybe you call that emotion. What's interesting is that human beings, what's interesting about the music, I'm going down this road of going after this connection, music and the phenomena. Well, first of all, it's nothing new.
Yeah.
And secondly, it's something a lot of people have a hard time putting their head around. It. It's sort of like, it's so cliche, or it's so that why would you even go there?
Yeah.
There's an expression, writing about music is like dancing about architecture. It's something like, don't go there, only fools dare go. But
Yeah.
what's interesting is there's music abound in everything. We talked about vibrations, but in nature, every object, everything emits a frequency. Of course, there are animals that sing. You talked about, archetypes. It's interesting, because I think that our music comes from nature.
Yeah.
So the archetypes come from nature. They're, we're receiving somehow, the sun cycle emerges in consciousness, for example. But the sounds of like water lapping, there's the Satie's Gemmopedies, Eric Satie, and if you go listen to it, it has, what's the meter? I'm sure someone can give the meter and say it's exactly this, but to me it sounds like water lapping. There's music that comes from the sounds of crickets, rain, thunder, Led Zeppelin, right?
Oh, yeah,
Heavy
absolutely.
music. Those archetypes come from somewhere, and we've sort of absorbed it and incorporated it into what we play and how we play. But human beings, like primates, are not very musical. That's the interesting thing, is primates, like birds, and not all birds sing. There's a smaller subset of birds that sing. But primates hoot and holler and bang, are not very musical. And it is, though it's been written about that when primates became bipedal, started to walk up and freed their hands. First of all, we joked in the cafe that in walking, in some respects, music has a walking speed. It has, there's something, there's movement. Music is always associated to movement. Someone asked me, how come you only talked about music in this book? And I said, well, because I didn't want to write a 1,000-page book.
Yeah,
And
because you have to choose a direction. I mean, you can talk about everything or not.
yeah, exactly. And so I feel like I have some authority to talk about music. I'm interested in music. I've read a lot. I'm a musician. I have something to say.
Yeah.
So I'll leave it to others to explore. But there's no question that music is always related to movement. But maybe when, these are speculations, but when when early human beings, you know, what we begin to call human beings, when their hands are free, you know, maybe in making, there's this co-evolution of hand dexterity and brain, also tongue as well.
Yeah.
And that we got to a point where our anatomy could facilitate more complex, making more complex sounds and rhythms. And those rhythms may have come from working, from moving, you know, in a UFO symphonic, I talk about, and I forget where he's from, and I forget the writer, but there are in Africa, there are music in certain countries in Africa is considered, you're a healer. You're actually brought to, you may be brought to a work situation to help improve the morale of workers, to help make them better workers. And so you have work music. So you have certain kind of music that you sing to that you can maybe do something physical and repetitive.
Yeah.
And the musician is viewed as someone, you know, like a doctor.
Yeah.
You know, in our culture, music, you know, you're either Bruce Springsteen or, you know, the old joke is, what's the difference between a pizza and a musician? A pizza can actually feed a family of three, you know. But in our culture, you're either esteemed, you're this kind of superstar, or, you know, it's nice that, oh, it's so nice that Bobby plays the violin. You know, Bobby, why don't you go get your violin?
Yeah, yeah.
Play for us.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, but it's yeah, please go ahead.
Sorry. No, I was just going to say that it's interesting, like the roles of musicians in our culture, like they there is the sense that they are from a performative aspect. It's like there is a, you know, I don't know, in some sense, they can become kind of a shaman for modern culture. And I was just thinking that, that's why I kind of opened my mouth. I shouldn't have interrupted you, but my point
no, it's fine.
Was just that there is a sense that because there is that emotional communicability with music where like someone's playing a series of chords and even with no words, people can get the mood of it. It's sort of a way to a mechanical way to achieve some sort of telepathic connection because everyone is connected to what the emotion or the tone of the music, but then also the rhythm. There's like a heartbeat or a thing that goes along that everyone kind of gets carried along. So you see the dancing, and it's known to help produce trance states, which is I think a place of psychic receptivity. So it's almost as if music has been seen and throughout human history as a way to kind of get into those visionary spaces. And I think in the past we viewed musicians as holy people or shaman. That's kind of changed in some ways, where there's a cheapening of that. But then there's also still figures who kind of take on that power when they do become musicians. I mean, we were talking about at the cafe, the Beatles and other folks who sort of produced these huge cultural waves in the wake of their music. And it's because they connected with a vast amount of people and propelled them all kind of in the same emotional, social direction. And it proved transformative for the whole culture. So, I mean, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I want
to. No, you didn't. And you should, because this is a conversation. But you said so many things there. You know, music is telepathic. I was talking to Josh Cutchin and we were discussing, it's in UFO Symphonic.
Yeah.
And you can't stop and say, oh, by the way, can you change the key now and let's change rhythm? Oh, I have a new melody I'm introducing. In jazz, you're kind of have to communicate on some other level. And anyone that plays music, it's both audience and musicians. There's the musicians hit a place and there's an Oz effect. There's something that happens. There's this delicate change in the electromagnetic field. The musician knows it. The audience knows it. We all experience it together. It happens in live music. And in most cultures, and even in our culture, we all know how powerful music is. We all know. We can act like, if you're the most serious, you know, I sort of joke around, the most serious, you know, CEO type of a, you know, tech bro company, and you're drive in your expensive Corvette or whatever you drive, and but you put in your music, and you're in some dreamland as you're on your way to your meeting where you're gonna, dominate the board and kind of that you're set the goals, the financial kick off the year, whatever.
Yeah.
But we all go to that place. We all go to that place, and some people do it intentionally. So you mentioned, shamans for sure, prayer and chanting, anyone who chants. So when people struggle with meditation, I always say, try a mantra. That really helps because you keep coming back to the mantra, Om Mani Padme Om, or whatever your mantra is. It's probably better. It doesn't have words that convey specific meanings. It should be sound so that it's dissolving the ego. It's dissolving that rational container that we often live in, that world that where we, which is healthy, that what is Donald Hoffman talks about, that the consciousness that we have is evolved to make us adaptable to, running away from tigers, to obtaining food, to procreation. But it doesn't tell us the true and the whole thing. As if, I don't know if there is a true with a capital T, but there is more.
Yeah.
And so music and sound help to dissolve that that boundary of this world I live in, the everyday reality. Now you can take that very far. You can take that to a reverie, to a memory, to an incredibly transcendent experience. And if you're adept, if you're working with a shaman or you're working with a practice that has, techniques, so say binaural beats, for example, I think you're alluding to that. By the way, Like a Rolling Stone, it just came to me. That's the song I was trying to say. Shame on
Someone
me.
Gifted it to you. The goddess finally arrived.
Yeah, right.
It just came.
It just arrived in my head. But binaural beats, if you use binaural beats, Monroe, it's funny because I always want to say Bill Monroe, but that's bluegrass. Bob Monroe, Robert Monroe, he was a communications kind of business person, I think. And I forget how he came upon discovering binaural beats, but it's two different frequencies in either ear.
Yeah.
So they're going at different frequencies, and it creates this sort of hypnotic effect. It's very powerful.
Yeah.
And
pulse kind of, and it can be at different wavelengths, and you can choose which wavelength to listen to, or the actual tapes will take you on a journey through those. It's
right.
Fascinating.
And Bob Monroe writes about, I forget the title of the book, but he writes about, he would have these encounters with beings. And he would kind of return to a place. And the beings had a sense of humor, or the being. There was one being in particular, a very highly evolved sentience that kind of would tease him a little bit and would give him advice on, was telling him how the human race needed to evolve, needed to take care of the planet. Sounds familiar? It's interesting that experience happened through sound. But it happens in the UFO encounter experience. It happens in other, and not every UFO encounter experience is like that. Some are terrifying, some are highly traumatic. I always say, and I said at the outset here, none of these things have template where you just place this here and you F equals mass times acceleration. It always works like that. These are highly, they're highly nuanced. We can't make these things manifest.
Yeah.
You can create conditions. You can chant. You can pray. You can use binaural beats. You don't know if you can always replicate exactly something. There's some kind of magic that has to occur. There's some chance factor.
That's our show for the public version of Dreamland. For subscribers, on the other hand, we'll be back with author Mike Fiorito to explore Steven Spielberg's Disclosure Day movie and discuss how our trajectory as a species seems to be mirroring the Gnostic ideas of old.
Where is the unknown country? Is it out there in the stars? Or is it also somewhere else? Is it in us, in you? Unknown country, join us today. Go to unknowncountry.com right now and join us. Join the questions. Join the search. Join the adventure. Unknowncountry.com. There's no place like it in the world.
UAPs, aliens, magic, breakthrough tech, psi phenomenon, esoterica, psychedelics, cryptids, time slips, poltergeists, and sundry. The days of dismissing these complicated human experiences as mere delusions, hoaxes, fantasies, and dreams needs to be over. Instead, we need to explore and understand these events for what they might be telling us about the nature of the universe and of ourselves. The ancients taught that we're each an energetic expression of the living cosmos, but we still don't know what that means. What is real? What is fantasy? How do each of our lives and experiences fit within the broader tapestry of being? Are we alone? Where does narrative fit? And what happens when we die? Join me on Neon Galactic, a podcast produced by yours truly to push the boundaries of old paradigms in science, philosophy, ontology, anthropology, and more. This show is an experiment in radical hermeneutics, breaking down old walls to embrace the strange and existentially transformative, to get beyond old prejudices and realize at last that we are indeed more complicated and connected as a species than many of us ever dreamed. Find me on Patreon, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts to take a journey to unknown places on a quest to the limits of this reality and beyond. At such a fraught and dangerous moment in human history, the time has definitely come to reassess the wisdom of our ancestors and embrace the natural truths we've long rejected. Join our intrepid crew in throwing open the gates of perception to welcome wonder back into the workaday world.
You've been listening to Dreamland. Be sure to tune in again next week. Dreamland is brought to you by UnknownCountry.com and its family of subscribers. Our theme music is The O of Pleasure by Ray Lynch. Unknown Country was founded by Ann Streber. Our news editor is Matthew Frizzell. Our coordinator is Amy Safrankova. Whitley Streber is your Dreamland host. And I'm your announcer, Ted Alexander.